Okay, today we are going to discuss bilirubin metabolism and jaundice. Now, as you all know that we use bilirubin measurement as a general liver function test, and so there are many, many different diseases or conditions in which this can go up. So I'm not obviously going to talk about all liver diseases in this conference, but mainly look at it from the bilirubin point of view, that where what you can learn from bilirubin metabolism and about the general function of the liver and specific diseases which are caused by high bilirubin levels. Okay, so bilirubin, why do you have to spend an hour on bilirubin metabolism? You don't spend an hour on every chemical. So one reason is that this is the end product of heme degradation, and so heme metabolism is of course extremely important. Serum bilirubin level is of course a clinical marker of hepatobiliary and excretory functions, and bilirubin is an endogenous marker that can be many things, including various drugs and hormones, etc. And hepatic uptake, storage and conjugation and excretion of bilirubin are finely balanced mechanisms. So if the body needs to increase bilirubin throughput, it has to increase all the different steps. Sometimes you hear that what is the rate limiting step in bilirubin metabolism? Is it the conjugation, uptake or excretion? But the point is that all of them are finely balanced. Any one that goes down is going to cause hyperbilirubinemia. Okay, so there are two major sources of bilirubin. One is erythroid, which is from the breakdown of senescent red cells, and the other is non-erythroid, which is not insignificant. It accounts for 20% of the bilirubin production in humans. And that comes from cytochromes, catalase, peroxidase, tryptophan pyrrolase, the heme-containing proteins. Although these proteins are much less in volume or weight compared to hemoglobin, but these proteins turn over much more rapidly. So they contribute 20% of bilirubin. Myoglobin turns over very slowly, so it is not a major contributor to bilirubin. And then the erythroid phase becomes abnormal in hemolysis, either intravascular or extravascular, and also in ineffective erythropoiesis, where heme is being produced, but the red cells are not being produced appropriately because of some kind of deficiency, either inherited or acquired, so the heme gets degraded and makes more bilirubin. Okay, so if you injected a precursor, radio-labeled precursor of heme, for example, glycine in this case, and you just measured the excretion of the bilirubin breakdown products in bile, that is, in humans, it is done by measuring the stool. This was one of the earliest experiments in which radioisotopes were used. So if the radioactivity comes out, there is no way of using it. Here's a point. So you get two peaks. It comes out initially as a peak, which is called the early level peak, and later as the late level peak. So the initial peak comes from breakdown of red cells. So if there is ineffective erythropoiesis or hemolysis, this peak is going to become big. And the later one is from breakdown of red cells. So if the red cells are breaking down, the half-life becomes shorter, then this peak will shift towards the left. Now here it says 40 to 80 days. This slide was made from rats. In humans, that would be 120 days. That's the half-life of red cells. Now, I have to mention a few words about the chemistry of bilirubin, because it is important to learn that little bit of chemistry for understanding the physiology of bilirubin. So it comes from heme, which is a tetrapyrrole, four pyrrole rings which are linked in the center to iron, and then these bridges that connect the pyrroles are not exactly identical, but the side chains are different. So one of the bridges, that is called the alpha bridge, that is attacked by oxygen, which is catalyzed by the enzyme or enzymes, heme oxygenase. And that would oxidize this carbon, which would be excreted as carbon monoxide. And the iron would be released, and this would make a linear compound like this, which is green and is called biliverdin. And in some animals, it would be excreted as a green pigment, like in some furred animals like nutria or rabbits. But in most animals, mammals and most fish, it is further converted to bilirubin, which is a yellow-orange pigment. The rubin implies red, that's because in alkali it looks orange or red. But as we know that bilirubin in the body bound to plasma albumin is yellow. So that conversion happens through another enzyme called biliverdin reductase, which is a cytosolic enzyme. So I'm not going to go into great details of this, but you have to remember that breakdown of heme is the major source of carbon monoxide that is produced inside the body. So if you take a non-smoker, or exclude some people who are toll collectors and the toll booths who have to inhale all that carbon monoxide, in most people, just by measuring how much carbon monoxide is being produced by from the exhaled air, one can determine how much heme is breaking down. And in a steady state, where the hemoglobin is remaining constant, if you know how much heme is breaking down, you also know how much heme is being produced. So it's a measure of heme synthesis, and this can be very important in patients with renal failure who are getting anemia, and you are wondering whether the heme synthesis is going down and the patient needs erythropoietin. You can determine it by this. Okay, so far what I showed, that would have produced this linear molecule, and if bilirubin, had bilirubin been a linear molecule like this, which Fischer described, then it would have these carboxyl side chains and these amino groups, which would have been water soluble, and it wouldn't have needed conjugation, it would have just been excreted. So obviously it cannot be like this. So all these polar groups, which are shown in red, are somehow not available to react with water. And the reason it is not available is that it forms internal hydrogen bonds. So these bonds, shown in blue, will engage all the polar groups. And the bilirubin is a contorted molecule. It's a ridge-type kind of structure, the one that goes on the top of the roof. Not used that much in this country, mostly it's in England. But anyway, so this is called ridge tile because of that. And so, because of the hydrogen bonding, all polar groups are engaged. And this central bridge becomes buried and protected. So when you add a DSO reagent, so this will not immediately react. So you have to add some kind of accelerator to get a reaction beyond conjugated bilirubin. Now, if the bridges were disrupted or broken, then the DSO reagent would react immediately, and that would be called direct reacting bilirubin, where you don't need to add an accelerator. Basically, now we know from the crystallographic structure that accelerators work by disrupting the hydrogen bonds of bilirubin. Okay, so this is the so-called ridge-tile structure of bilirubin. Now, in nature, the hydrogen bonds are broken by conjugation with glucuronic acid. And if you add a glucuronic acid to these carboxyls, like this, then they cannot form hydrogen bonds. And that's the reason bilirubin becomes water soluble under these situations and will come out in light. And when you give phototherapy to newborns to reduce bilirubin, the way it works is that it changes the configuration of these bridges. And by doing that, the carbon comes in way of the hydrogen bonds and disrupts the hydrogen bonds. As a result, it becomes momentarily water soluble and it comes out in the bile and then it forms the bonds again and becomes the same bilirubin. So this is how phototherapy mainly works. It also breaks down a little bit of bilirubin, but that's a small part. Mostly it just makes a geometric or conformational isomer of bilirubin. Okay, so I already talked about the DSO reagent and why that you would get a direct and indirect reaction, so I'm not going to spend more time on that. Because if the hydrogen bond is broken, then the central bridge will be exposed and the molecule will be attacked and it will produce the two azodipyrroles of one bilirubin. Okay, now let us see how the body gets rid of bilirubin. Firstly, bilirubin is produced not mainly in the liver, mainly in the spleen and bone marrow where the reticular endothelial cells are and the red cell breakdown happens. But some bilirubin is produced in the liver also because the liver is the home of cytochromes. There's a lot of cytochromes and tryptophan pyrrolase which is broken down inside the liver, and so the liver contributes about 20% of bilirubin. So most of the bilirubin will have to come to the liver through the liver sinusoids. This is a diagram of a hepatocyte. This is another hepatocyte. That's part of another hepatocyte. And this is the sinusoidal surface which comes in contact with the blood. And this is the canalicular surface which is the beginning of the biliary excretion. So the beginning of the canaliculus is in the hepatocyte. And these are closed by tight junctions on both sides. And this is the liver sinusoid. And these are the endothelial cells, which are different from other endothelial cells of the body because they are fenestrated, they have holes in them. So the plasma comes in direct contact with the sinusoidal surface of the hepatocyte. And bilirubin arrives into the liver sinusoid bound to albumin. Because if it was not bound to albumin, because of its nonpolar structure, it would have been water insoluble. It would have been deposited in tissues. So it comes here bound to albumin, and then that will keep the bilirubin soluble and will prevent its toxicity. So if the bilirubin was not bound to albumin and it passes through the brain, it will be deposited in the brain and cause connectors. And so the corollary of that is that the drugs that displace bilirubin from albumin binding could precipitate connectors even without raising the bilirubin level, because it simply compete with bilirubin binding to albumin and release it. And so it will be deposited in tissues.
Well, if you think the blood-brain barrier have to be damaged, or, you know, or
okay, so the blood-brain barrier is an interesting concept. It actually, that's not the main thing that happens, because in the babies, when the blood-brain barrier, the bilirubin enters the brain along with albumin, so it doesn't become toxic at that point. But what happens is that when bilirubin goes inside the brain, it is also exported outside the brain. So if for some reason it cannot get out, for example if there is local acidosis that will release it from the albumin binding, then it will get deposited. So it is not just the blood-brain barrier, because that would not have caused toxicity by itself, but blood-brain barrier plus something else. In adults, cardiac arrest can also happen. It happens mainly in patients with Crigler-Najjar syndrome, where the bilirubin is high. So if there is such drugs or acidosis or some other illness, that can precipitate cardiac arrest. And the drugs that are notorious for doing that are sulfonamides. When sulfonamides were first introduced, you know, they were miracle drugs, and they were given to babies to prevent sepsis. And that gave rise to the first epidemic of cardiac arrest. And before people realized that it was the sulfonamide that was causing it, there were quite a few deaths from that drug. Okay, so this albumin-bilirubin complex must dissociate, and albumin will flow through, and bilirubin will enter into the liver, and this happens by a mechanism called facilitated diffusion. Now there is a difference between diffusion and transport. Diffusion means that it can go only downhill, the concentration gradient. It can be facilitated by proteins, but it will not go uphill. Whereas transport, which uses energy, can transport it against a concentration gradient. So here it is a facilitated diffusion, and what exactly does that is not quite known, but it does not consume energy. So there are several situations where this can be abnormal. Particularly, you should remember in cirrhosis, the fenestrated endothelium is replaced by regular endothelium, like capillary endothelium. And so this transport will not happen very well, in addition to the collaterals, which will not allow the bilirubin to be cleared by first pass, because blood from spleen will go first to the general circulation. Okay, so inside the liver, bilirubin is bound to the main cytosolic group of proteins, which is glutathione S transferases. So like albumin is the main protein in the plasma, inside the liver cell, it is the GSTs. The glutathione S transferases, by the way, were first discovered in this institution at Einstein, and it was called ligandin. Some people still call it ligandin, because it binds ligands, many ligands. Now, because this is a facilitated diffusion, bilirubin will try to go out as well as come in. But one, because it is bound to GSTs, that inhibits the efflux of bilirubin. So that will increase the rate uptake of bilirubin. So although it came in by diffusion, it gets bound to GSTs and it cannot get out so easily, so it gets trapped. And then the next step will have to happen, because of course, you know, there is not enough capacity of GSTs to keep absorbing it forever. So the next step is conversion of bilirubin to bilirubin glucuronides. And that is mediated by an enzyme called UGT1A1. The whole thing would be UDP, glucuronosyl transferase, type 1A1. Now, it is not called just glucuronyl transferase, it is called UDP glucuronyl transferase, because it cannot transfer free glucuronic acid to bilirubin. It can only take the glucuronic acid from UDP glucuronic acid and transfer it to bilirubin. Now, the energy consumed in this process is in generating the UDP glucuronic acid. That's where the energy is consumed. So from UDP glucuronic acid, this would become UDP, and this glucuronic acid would be transferred to bilirubin. And once that is formed, so this is much less biologically active, so it's less toxic, and it is polar, that is water soluble. So now it can go out. Okay, let's skip this. So now it can go out in the body. So then there are several inherited disorders in which the
conjugation is defective. Now, of that, the most severe form is Crigler-Najjar syndrome, type 1. And here, virtually, there is no UGT1A1 activity. Then there is type 2, where the activity is less than 10% because of some mutations. And third is Gilbert syndrome, which is very common. The other two are rare. Gilbert syndrome is present in a clinical form in 4% of the population. Genetically, it is present in 9% of the population. Okay, so here in Crigler-Najjar syndrome type 1, the serum bilirubin level would go up from to 18 to 40 milligrams per deciliter. And in type 2, it is 8 to 18 milligrams. So there is some overlap. Here, carnictinus will happen unless you treat it very vigorously. Here, carnictinus does happen, especially when there is some intercurrent illness. And in Gilbert syndrome, that is normally doesn't do any harm because the bilirubin level ranges from normal to up to 5 milligrams. But there are some other drugs that are also detoxified by UGT1A1. So those drugs will give higher blood levels and can cause some toxicity in Gilbert syndrome.
Sometimes, by taking up the
bilirubin
transferase, cause the bilirubin to be high,
like
by competition?
Yeah, if you get a very high dose, bilirubin level would increase with those drugs. But that would need a lot of dose, and that's going to cause toxicity by itself, not through bilirubin level. We are talking about, these are cancer drugs, like irinotecan. Okay, so Crigler-Najjar syndrome type 1 and type 2 are rare, both are recessively inherited. Gilbert syndrome, which is common, is also recessively inherited. Now, usually, the recessive diseases are uncommon, but this abnormality is so common, the genotype is so common, that even a recessive disease is common. Yeah. And so bilirubin conjugates are almost absent in bile. In type 2 and in Gilbert, the bilirubin have two carboxyl groups on bilirubin. So if there can be two glucuronic acids attached, that is called diglucuronide. That is the main conjugate in humans. 80% to 90% of bilirubin excreted is diglucuronide. However, in these conditions where the activity is reduced and still some conjugate is being produced, a lot of the bilirubin is monoglucuronide. So if there is over 30% of the bilirubin in bile is monoglucuronide, that would indicate either Crigler-Najjar type 2 or Gilbert syndrome. And this can be determined by high pressure liquid chromatography of the bile.
So what exactly happens with
irinotecan? The irinotecan is an intermediate metabolite which has to be glucuronidated to be excreted. Now if the and there are many different forms of UGT. Only one form conjugates bilirubin, UGT1A1. So if that enzyme is reduced in activity, so there will be a higher blood level of the intermediary metabolite of irinotecan. So that will give rise to diarrhea in patients who have Gilbert syndrome more commonly than in other people. Okay, now, if you induce the enzyme by giving phenobarbital, then in Crigler-Najjar syndrome, there will be no effect because there is no enzyme activity at all. In type 2, phenobarbital will reduce serum bilirubin, and the thumb is if it decreases it more than 25%, it is probably type 2. And in Gilbert syndrome, serum bilirubin will be normalized, but nobody needs to treat Gilbert syndrome with phenobarbital, excepting maybe somebody's having a wedding or whatever, so you don't want to look young. So this is Victor Najjar and John Crigler. Victor Najjar was fishing and John Crigler was ready to give a lecture. So I took quick pictures of them. Okay, now, what causes this disease? So this is something that we discovered in our lab. The UGT1A1 locus is a very interesting locus. So if you look at the exons 2 to 5, everybody knows what an exon is, right? An exon and an intron. Exons are part of the gene that will give rise to the messenger RNA that will code for the protein. So these four exons are used by many different enzymes. And upstream to that, there is a series of exons which are called exon 1, exon 1, 1 star 1, all the way up to 1 star 12. Now, only one of these exons will hook up with these four exons to give rise to one messenger RNA. Now, if the exon 1A1, this one, hooks up with this four, that will give rise to UGT1A1. If, say, the exon 1 star 6 hooks up with this four, that will give UGT1A6. That's how the nomenclature is done. So the thing to remember that is that the common region, this part, is identical in all the UGT forms. And this part that comes from the exon 1s, that's the N-terminal region, that is unique in these forms. And mutation of either this exon or any of these four exons can give rise to Krigler-Najar 1 or Krigler-Najar 2. The mutations, of course, can be missense or nonsense. So if it's a missense mutation, that is, it changes only one amino acid, then that amino acid may be critical for the enzyme activity and may make Krigler-Najar type 1, or it may be somewhat important and make type 2. In Gilbert syndrome, the mechanism is completely different. This was also discovered in our lab. Here, the structural part of the gene is completely normal, but the promoter is abnormal. And it is slightly abnormal. That is, normally it is A, then 6 TAs and then TAA. In Gilbert's, it is A, then 7 TAs and TAA. So that one TA duplex is added to this. That's it. And that's what reduces the promoter activity and produces only 30% of the enzyme. So this is one of the few diseases known for sure where a disease is caused by promoter. Okay, so Krigler-Najar type 1, the treatment is...
How are we doing with time?
So I have to go quickly. So previously all the infants died before 1 year. Now giving routine phototherapy has extended the life. During emergency, bilirubin can be removed by plasmapheresis and thin vasoporfiring, which competes for hemoxygenase, can be given to reduce the bilirubin production. And that would reduce the bilirubin level for a week to 2 weeks. So this is important only during crisis, cannot be given long term. But now liver transplantation is the only curative therapy. It has been done in 14 patients successfully. We have done liver cell transplantation in one patient, which was reported in the New England Journal. Some of you may have read that or remember that. That reduced the bilirubin level by 50% by just transplanting liver cells through the portal vein. Since then, in Europe, about 8 cases have been done with similar results. But it doesn't completely cure the hyperbilirubinemia. For that, you still have to transplant the liver, or at least one lobe of the liver. So this is the phototherapy chamber in which these Krigler-Najar children are kept, blue light, for 12 to 16 hours a day. Unless they can run around in the sun during summer, that is okay. If the phototherapy is withdrawn, even for a couple of weeks, which was done by wrong advice in this kid, and that can cause permanent brain damage, even in a couple of weeks. Okay, and several drugs would increase the UGT1A1 activity, and they can be used for fibrinogen syndrome type 2, phenobarbital, clofibrate, rifampin. Interestingly, thyroid hormone will reduce the UGT1A1 activity, and it can increase bilirubin levels. So during thyroid storm, you always have hyperbilirubinemia. But in just regular hyperthyroidism, it will increase the bilirubin level, particularly in Gilbert syndrome patients. Okay, now the excretory defects. There are two main excretory defects that you need to know about. One is Dubin-Johnson syndrome, the other is Rotor syndrome. Now, Dubin-Johnson syndrome is a disease of canalicular excretion, and it is caused by the defect of one particular enzyme, an ATP-consuming pump, which is called MRP2. Now, this pump excretes many different compounds. So all those will build up in the body and in the liver, including leukotrienes and various other things. Importantly, the organic anion that it does not handle are the bile salts. So in any inherited disease, if you want to distinguish an inherited liver disease causing jaundice from an acquired liver disease causing jaundice, you can measure bile salts. So in none of the inherited liver diseases, bile salt level will be significantly increased. Whereas almost in all acquired liver diseases, if there is jaundice, bile salt levels will be increased. Okay, so Rotor syndrome is not a syndrome of canalicular transport. It's a syndrome of hepatic storage. So in that way, it is similar to many other liver diseases. So biliary excretion we talked about. Now, because the biliary excretion is abnormal in Dubin-Johnson syndrome, some pigments accumulate in the liver, and the liver becomes black. So if you take a needle biopsy, you don't even have to do a histology. Just by looking at it, you can tell whether it is Dubin-Johnson syndrome. And if you do histology, you can see these deep yellow or brown pigments, which are not bilirubin. It is something related to melanin that is retained because of the same canalicular defect. Serum bilirubin level is only 3 to 5 milligrams per deciliter, which means that there must be some alternative ways by which the rest of the bilirubin is excreted. Okay, so if you want to compare Dubin-Johnson and Rotor syndrome, this is an excretory defect, this is a storage disorder. This is benign and rare, but it is more common in Sephardic Jews, 1 in 1300. And this is also benign and rare, but this is found worldwide. Here there is accumulation of pigments, here there is no pigmentation. If you inject DSP, it is taken up normally. Does anybody know about the DSP test, which is not done very commonly anymore? So if you inject DSP and take blood samples, you can see the DSP goes down, goes up after it, because it is taken up by the liver. In liver disease, it will take a much longer time to go down. So if you take a 45-minute sample, you will find a higher blood level in liver disease. But 45 minutes, it becomes normal because it is taken up by the liver, but then it regurgitates back into the blood. So you get a secondary peak. So you get a double peak in Dubin-Johnson syndrome. In Rotor syndrome, VSP clearance is slower like other liver diseases because it's a storage disorder, but you don't get the double peak because there is no excretory defect.
The unconjugated bilirubin in this case, is it because there's some kind of feedback on the transport, like transport of...
The UGT enzyme activity is a bidirectional activity. So it moves to the right only if you remove the product. If the product accumulates, then unconjugated bilirubin will also. There is no liver disease
acquired or inherited, where do you get only conjugated bilirubin in blood? So you
either get all unconjugated bilirubin or you get a mixture of conjugated and unconjugated. Now the porphyrin expression in urine is very characteristic. So in most liver diseases, including Rotor syndrome, there is an increase in the total amount of coproporphyrin excreted in urine. And the breakdown between type 1 and type 3 is about half and half. So that's found in most liver diseases and Rotor syndrome. In Dubin-Johnson syndrome, it is very interesting that the total porphyrin is increased, but it is increased because of an increase of type 1 porphyrin. Normal copper porphyrin in urine is type 3. So here, the component that increases is the type 1. So 90% of the porphyrin will be type 1, but the total copper porphyrin is not significantly increased. So this is what is characteristic of Dubin-Johnson syndrome. So it can be diagnosed simply by a urine analysis if you have a way of distinguishing type 1 and type 3, which is tilial chromatography. Okay, to summarize then, so hyperbilirubinemia, so you first do a clinical evaluation, and if the liver enzymes are abnormal, then of course you have to think of hepatitis or cholestasis, biliary obstruction, things like that. If the liver enzymes, that is SGOT, SGPT, alkaline phosphatase, gamma GT, if these are normal, then you have to look at whether the bilirubin is nearly all indirectly active or is it a mixture. If it is all indirectly acting, then you think of hemolysis, like splenomegaly, you look for high, whether LDH is increased, whether the lactic count is increased, whether the haptoglobin is decreased. You think of drugs like rifampin or radiographic contrast media, which can decrease the uptake. And you think of inherited disorders like Gilbert syndrome, Prader-Willi syndrome, type 1 and 2. If it is, if a large component is directly active, and then you do a quick bisalt measurement if you can. If that is normal, you think of Dubin-Johnson syndrome or Rotor syndrome. You can make a diagnosis by urine porphyrin examination. If not, if a liver biopsy is done, then you will see a black liver, and then the diagnosis becomes obvious before you send the tissue to the pathologist. So the implications are the bilirubin throughput by the hepatocyte involves four discernible steps: uptake, the mechanism is unidentified, storage by GST binding, conjugation by UGT1A1, and excretion by MRP2, which is an ATP consuming pump, therefore it can excrete against a concentration gradient. So in bile, the bilirubin level can be 50-fold higher than in the liver. The four steps are finely balanced, and therefore reduction of any step can cause hyperbilirubinemia. And enhancement of the throughput would require increase of all the steps. And that can be done coherently because there are nuclear receptors which can be activated by drugs which will simultaneously raise all the four steps.